good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Clifford Kynecorn. Clifford, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here tonight.
Well, Clifford is going to be speaking on chemtrails. He's going to be speaking at the conspiracy conference that's going to be held up in Santa Clara, just across the hills from where I live. It's going to be on the 29th and 30th of this month. And it's going to be at the conference center next to Great American Hotel there. But if you'd like more details, why don't you call 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. Or you can go to their website, which is conspiracycon.com. That's conspiracycon for conference.com. And you'll get more information. Should be an interesting time. A lot of our friends are going to be there. Joyce Riley, Len Horowitz, Rodney Stitz, Eric Kupfschmidt, Clifford's going to be there. A number of the people that we've had on our program will be attending the conference, and I'll have a booth. I'm not speaking this year, but I enjoyed the program last year, so I'm going again this year. Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, Clifford, about your background and how you came to be interested in chemtrails.
Sure, Dr. Stan. I am at this point, a self-employed computer consultant in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've been self-employed now for the past 6 years. My background prior to that was an employee of the federal government for 15 years within three different agencies, including the United States Forest Service, the Department of Defense, and the Bureau of Land Management. And my work was primarily in the technical fields. My background is in the sciences, mathematics, geophysics, and this type of thing. And that was the culmination of my career with the Defense Department, was in a field called geodesy, which is a geophysical mathematical field. So that's a little bit about my background. However, in terms of my current work with related to this subject, which I refer to as the aerosol issue, aerosol crimes, I realize the popular term used is chemtrails. I personally don't use that term because of certain difficulties. There is no formal definition of that term, and that alone can serve as a pretext for denial and avoidance of the issue. And with my background, I attempt to describe the events and observations based on at least language that's accepted in the scientific as well as the professional community. And in terms of my involvement, I'm acting entirely as a citizen here. I am an independent researcher. I have no affiliation with the federal government anymore. I'm not acting under employee status. I am acting as a citizen. I have no background prior to this event as any type of environmental activist, but I was upset and disturbed enough by what I see as criminal activity that has taken place in particularly in our atmosphere, that I was motivated to call attention to it in a public sense. And this began at the early part of 1999, February 14th, Valentine's Day of 1999, was the day that I took my first photograph and used the vehicle and medium of the Internet for disclosure.
Well, you know, this is the most incredible thing. I know that a lot of people just don't believe in chemtrails, but when you actually see these planes going back and forth and blacking forth, planes don't fly, you know, those sort of patterns. You know, here in Santa Cruz, sometimes they will simply spray and spray, and we hear this is really going on all over the world, and these are sort of unmarked planes. They sound like something having to do with the CIA. They've been described many times by many people. They've even gotten pretty good pictures of the planes. But as to exactly what they're doing, nobody is exactly certain, other than they're spraying something and they're causing this cloudiness of the skies at times. So, you know, what are your thoughts? What are they up to? Why are they doing this? Some people think that they're spreading disease. Others think it has to do with weather modification. Other people, well, they're just a million different explanations out there. And I think they're intentionally trying to confuse us. There are a lot of people who say it couldn't be true, and they won't even look up at the sky. But after you've looked up long enough, you become convinced they're up to something.
In an absolute sense, certainly the intent of the project and operations is not known. And that is because we are dealing with a covert operation. This is a covert operation, I do believe, on the grandest scale that history has ever witnessed, and it certainly exceeds the type of containment that is associated with weapon system development, as well as UFO phenomenon. If you look at history of that and how that has been handled, it shares many similarities in terms of the efforts to contain the dissemination of information, truthful information on it. So, realistically, I think it's, in an absolute sense, no, we don't exactly know, because it would not be a successful covert operation if that was the case. However, my role is that primarily as a researcher, and therefore I observe, I collect data, I analyze, I use my background, my particular skills, and apply them towards, let's say, number one, making information available. That's certainly the primary function. To collect what I would regard as evidence to substantiate my claims that criminal activities are occurring. And then along with that, through the evolution, certainly is an attempt to interpret and analyze this information the best that I'm able to as to what I think the agendas can be. And so I also do not think we are totally clueless at this point. We now have 5 years of research, and I believe we know quite a bit, although it is based upon analysis. It is not based upon any disclosure of documents, or at least very little in the way of documents. I will answer the question when, you know, folks ask, what the heck are they up to, this way. And that is that there are now five, what I would call, areas of endeavor. There are five areas of application or endeavor that I have identified that I regard as all of them inclusive. They are all they are all consistent with all of the data that has accumulated over 5 years. And therefore, when these five are mentioned, it's not as though you would pick a single one. I see none of them as being exclusive of one another, and I believe there's a great deal of overlap between these. The five areas are as follows. The first would be that of environmental modification and control. This is the aspect that is usually easiest for people to relate to, understand, even accept in terms of information that's available.
Now, are you referring perhaps to some sort of weather modification or a shield or global warming or what?
Certainly, this would be a part of it. When I speak of, and these will be general terms because from this point on you have to dig into each one individually. But yes, when I speak of environmental modification and control, it means exactly that. Our physical environment, including weather, primarily the weather system. But, you know, there's a lot of aspects to the environment also. But certainly weather control and manipulation being dominant within that. The second would be the use of electromagnetic energy, propagation and control manipulation of electromagnetic energy in ways that most people would not associate immediately with this type of operation because the physics behind it is a little bit conceptual until you have a picture of it, which I can try to describe, and then actually becomes fairly elementary in terms of the principles behind it, but very, very fundamental in terms of its importance and likely role in terms of an agenda. The third is a very disturbing and distressing aspect, and there are many folks that would prefer I don't talk about it, but as a researcher, I simply present the data that I see, and that is biological operations. There is a body of information, data, and evidence that consistently and repeatedly shows a biological aspect to these operations. And the implications of that are, at the very least, very disturbing. The fourth would be that of military operations, and certainly one can see that these areas can overlap, but there's a wide array of military applications that are consistent with this. And the last is more conceptual, but nevertheless I can't dismiss it, and that's on a very grand scale. And that considers the prospect of geophysical and planetary modification, which is on an even grander scale than environmental. And this would have to do with energy, the actual energy of the entire Earth on a geophysical scale. And I realize it's more conceptual, and yet at the same time there is a logical basis for that conclusion.
Now, you're talking about something like the shifting of the poles that they're talking about, or
conceivably, you know, we could go over that a little bit, and I can tell you why that evolved, why that topic evolved. What we do know, what is certainly clear, is that the planet has been modified. The atmosphere of the planet, as a starting point, you can go from there. But the atmosphere of this planet has been modified. It is changed. And therefore, we already have a planetary modification, even at that most elementary level. So then it's more a matter of discussing energy and the accumulation and use of energy.
Well, you know, it's the most amazing thing. It was about 6 months or so ago when a young man who used to work here at the station, you know, called us and said early in the morning and said that there'd been spring and that this had come down and was on the trees around his house. Well, sounded pretty far-fetched, but he came up later in the day. He had pictures of the trees all decked, and now, of course, where we live, we don't get any snow, with a sort of almost white strands around it, like you might put on a Christmas tree. And then he actually had brought a bag full of this for me, and it's sort of almost like a gelatinous material that he was actually able to collect from this. And they'd been spraying very, very heavy this morning, and whatever it had done, it consolidated and come down in his area very, very heavily. So there is something there. There's no question at all that it's there. This is probably a CIA operation of some sort, or one of the intelligence agencies. But they have the ability to keep this secret from the people, because, of course, we aren't smart enough to understand what they're doing. Or maybe we are smart enough to understand, and they fear the American people might wake up before it's too late. So why don't you pick off, Clifford, do you want to start with number one and just sort of develop these five ideas?
Sure, we can do that, and there's a, you know, you could pick any one of these topics, you go into it in depth, and then when you work through it eventually, you'll start to see the connections that cross over between them. Your description of this physical material, this web-like material, I'm assuming it was of a strand web-like material,
right.
Is a fascinating topic in itself, and we could talk about that. I will a little bit because it'll lay the set the stage for the fact that we know that there is not an honest attempt to address the request of citizens for investigation of this issue, even with the submission and presence of physical material such as you're describing. To talk for a minute on this material that you're describing, this web material, there's probably about four types of materials, four to five types of physical materials that have been repeatedly identified by numerous citizens across the country. And when I speak of these, I would not speak of them if there was a single isolated case. One of these classes of material is that of fibers or strands. Now, the common explanation proposed for this will be that you're seeing spider webs. And it's actually helpful for all of us to become familiar with the counterarguments so that we can, you know, consider that realistically. And, you know, everyone will have to work through this for themselves, but I can tell you that there is quite a body of evidence that will certainly disprove the claim that it is spider webs. We're dealing with something that is clearly engineered. And, you know, before I even got deeply involved with this, I had an individual send me a video. And this was back, the video came from 1998, and this fellow was in Oklahoma. And this was before it was even an issue, but he sent me this video that showed his entire hay field covered with this web material. And his attempts to call the FAA and get explanations and this type of thing. But it was so early in the game that most people did not realize the significance of it. That fibrous material has turned out to be a very important physical component of what is going on. And these fibers are submicron in thickness. Now, to give a sense of scale on that, a human hair is on the order of 60 to 100 microns thick. And asbestos fibers are roughly a couple of microns thick. And I've spent quite a bit of time with normal fiber analysis and this type of thing so I can distinguish what we're dealing with. A submicron fiber in itself is a phenomenal thing. If you consider the attention that has been given to asbestos fibers and the potential health hazard that they have in our environment, certainly if one were to disclose the presence of submicron fibers in the environment, apparently from an airborne source, you would think that there would be a investigation as to the source and identity of that material. This is not the case. It eventually progressed to the point where a colleague of mine, David Peterson, up in Colorado, jointly we sent a sample of this material. I have received a few samples of this over time now from citizens. A sample of this material was sent to the administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, who at that time was Carol M. Browner. It was sent by certified mail, and a letter was attached requesting identification of this material on behalf of the public interest, basically saying it appears to be airborne. We perceive it as a potential health risk. Please identify it. And there had been multiple reports and instances of this by the time this had been done. And was done with good faith and assertiveness, I'll say that, but in good faith and honestly seeking the public servants to perform their job. And the EPA, when they received this material, they never acknowledged receipt. We know that they got the letter. I have all the correspondence and all the certified receipts on the website, which is under my name, of carnicum.com. And we know that they received it, but they did not acknowledge the receipt of it. So they sent a letter back, and the response from the EPA was repeatedly, it happened three times at least, repeatedly stating, "We are not aware of any such aircraft operations." This is the phrase they chose to use, which was that we are not aware, never acknowledging receipt of the material, nor our request to have it identified. A year and a half transpired during which these letters repeated, even when we requested again. Keep repeating the phrase, "We are not aware." A year and a half passes, you have a Freedom of Information Act filed by an independent party, actually for a different motive, apparently because of disbelief of the claims and statements that were being made that they had been sent this material. After this Freedom of Information Act was filed, a year and a half later, the EPA mailed the sample back and stated, they used a phrase to the effect of, "It is not our policy, it is not the policy of this office to identify any unsolicited material." Now, there's two big problems with that statement. The first will be the use of the word policy, and the second will be use of the word unsolicited. And policy is basically a decision of the person in charge. It has no basis in law, and unsolicited means if they don't ask for it, that we don't have any obligation to do anything. I would contest both of those words and believe that they very much had a legal obligation, and that remains an outstanding issue of failure on the part of these public servants.
Well, of course, if they want to keep their job, they're going to keep quiet, they're going to do what they're told to do, and the last thing they really want to admit to the American people is that they're experimenting with our health, the health of our children, and of course the general well-being of this nation, and its very survival may be at stake. We'll be back here in just a moment or two, here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Clifford Carnicum. Is that the right way to pronounce it, Clifford?
Oh, very well. Yes, that's fine. Clifford Carnicum. Yeah, that's fine.
Clifford Carnicum is going to be speaking at the conference here, the conspiracy conference, on the 29th and 30th of this month up in the Santa Clara, just adjacent to Great American there. If you'd like more information, of course, I give them a call at 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. There's going to be a lot of different speakers. Some of them I would agree with. Some I probably wouldn't agree with, but I think it's important that people go get the information, and I would far rather sometimes hear a person I disagree with than a person I agree with. I think I'll be agreeing with Clifford here pretty well, although I think that at the end we're probably going to come up and say they don't want us to know what this is really about, but I really fear for my country when I reflect that you can have these secret operations and you have people operating in this country who are answerable to absolutely no one. And we're seeing the end result of what happens to that over in Iraq today, as America is being humiliated throughout the world, and justifiably so, when the one military officer who told the truth has been attacked because he has vilified the army by telling the truth. And he probably has ended his military career because he wouldn't go along with the cover-up. So, well, anyway, let's get back to the subject at hand, and that is the Environmental Protection Agency refused to accept the sample of whatever is being sprayed, denied that they ever gotten it, kept denying they ever got it, and finally sent it back saying that they weren't going to analyze it because it was unsolicited. Well, that, of course, simply is a cover. They do not want, I'm sure, ever to be put in a position of having to admit that they had the specimen and that they refused to analyze it because it might be hazardous to the health of the American people. So pick up the story, Clifford.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan. And the follow-through on that is another aspect that was not known at the time that this material was sent to the EPA. And that is, after it had been sent, I was called by a medical professional. He's a doctor. And he invited me to come to a location to look at a sample. And he prefaced it with a phrase, Clifford, I'm seeing something that you're not able to see with your equipment, because at the time I started my work, it was a $30 toy microscope that I was looking at these fibers with. It's since progressed a fair amount, but my resources are extremely limited. So he stated he was seeing some things that I was not able to see. I visited this individual. He had a very high-quality microscope, first class, of dark field. And we videoed the session. I have that record available, and many of those images are taken as stills and made available on the website. What was occurring was that this individual had a fiber sample identical to mine. Actually, he had received literally a part of the same sample I had. This individual had sent it to both of us. And this individual was seeing biological components in there.
In other words, were these some sort of germs or viruses or rickettsia or mycoplasma? Do we know what it was?
Well, this individual's assessment at the time, to the best of his ability, what he stated was, these appear to be desiccated erythrocytes. Erythrocytes are red blood cells. Has to come out eventually because we have to deal with the facts.
All right, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment with Clifford Carnicum, and we'll be talking about what was found when they analyzed what is being sprayed. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Clifford Carnicum, and this is an incredible story. They are spraying something, what it is. According to Clifford, he was called by a physician who had a microscope who was looking at under a very high magnification, and you say that he felt that they were desiccated red cells. Were these human red cells, or what were they?
To the best of his ability, this was his analysis. Now, at that time, That was quite surprising to me, but he had been looking at it for several weeks prior to calling me. During that session, I saw what he was referring to. I was untrained with my eye at that point to, you know, identify or recognize erythrocytes, at least visually. So I simply was an observer and recorded it and had a videotape available of it as part of the record. In addition, while I was there, he had stepped out of the room for a minute. I continued to look through the scope, and while I was there, I noticed a cluster that seemed very unusual to me. And when he came back in, I showed that to him, and he had not seen that before. He had seen individual cells, but within it, there were two of these. And they were clusters. They were clearly what I would call geometrically formed. They appear to have an artificial structure to them as opposed to some natural. They look like basically a grape cluster. And again, to the best of this individual's ability as a medical professional, he identified them as erythrocytes. At that point, I'm not passing any judgment. I'm simply receiving information. And not to overstate this, because people, when they become introduced to this subject, they need to build the foundation and go through the background on this to understand why what we're speaking of is not implausible, is not far-fetched at all. Take a look at the hearings in U.S. Senate hearings in 1977 involving the Department of Defense on biological weapons. And you ask yourself what was the basic issue of those Senate hearings, and it is exactly what we are speaking of now, and that is the dispersal of biological warfare agents, presumed to be harmless, but that again was a whole separate topic within the hearings, dispersal of airborne biological agents upon the United States population without their informed consent or knowledge. There is a precedent for the issue that I'm speaking of. So if a person's willing, and go look at the contractors in those Senate hearings, and you will see some very familiar phrases, such as freeze-dried methods being used and aerosol operations. These go back to the 60s and the 70s in terms of methods of operation. So it is not far-fetched.
Of course, much of this is covered, at least some of this is covered, in what we refer to as the Rockefeller Report, put out of the Veterans Administration over the name of Senator Jay Rockefeller in 1994, talking about the Gulf War Syndrome, but then talking about all of these macabre experiments carried out on the American people, a very brief approach to it. We do have the other report that you're referring to available through here, but the easiest one to read is the Rockefeller Committee Report, and then for those who want the advanced course, why there's experiments on use of biologicals. Do you recall the exact title of that report in 77?
It was, this is close, it's in my head, it was something like deficiencies in the Department of Defense. I'm going to try to find it while we're speaking here. Deficiencies in the Department of Defense, here we go. Hearings, Subcommittee on Health and Scientific Research, Committee on Human Resources, United States Senate, examination of serious deficiencies in the Defense Department's efforts to protect the human subjects of drug research. This is the title of it, and it's essentially about the biological warfare programs that were disclosed in the 70s that had been conducted in the 60s and 50s.
Well, there's no question that they have intentionally and maliciously experimented on large segments of our population, both in Southern California, here in Northern California. They used a serratia, sprayed it off the coast, and just to see what would happen. It got into Stanford Hospital. Patients got sick. One of them died. They had tried to bring a lawsuit. There was no question what had happened, but the judge wouldn't allow the facts to be brought out because it would be too embarrassing for the American people to know that our government, in the name of experimenting, just wanting in the name of science to find out what happened, had killed at least one American and incapacitated a number. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Clifford Conicum, and we're going to talk more about the so-called aerial spraying that's going on. Most people refer to it as chemtrails. But don't think for one minute that the people who would plunge us into war after war after useless war, never fighting those wars for the reason that we're told, would not experiment on the American people. If you doubt that's true, you need to get, well, call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Ask about getting a copy of the Rockefeller Committee report after you've read it. And read what we did to our boys who went to fight in the Gulf. You'll never look at the world through the same eyes again. To stand, I guess, this evening, Clifford Connicum. Clifford, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story from there?
Thank you, Dr. Stan. And my purpose here is not to cause undue alarm. My purpose is to disclose the facts and the evidence as I am best able to present them as a citizen activist. And although there are many people that would prefer that we just do not bring up this subject, it's simply a part of the record. And it needs to be dealt with. And that incident that I described to you with that particular doctor and the recording of these events, remember, this was therefore seen within these fibers that were sent to the EPA. But the time we sent them to the EPA, we didn't even know of this. So not only on the basis of the unusual characteristics of the fibers with respect to their size and physical qualities, there's another whole aspect that was operating behind the scenes that I absolutely had no idea of when I requested identification. And the record on my side continues to show I have advanced my methods best I can. The record on my side, I'm not a doctor, I don't claim to be, but I certainly have some time in the life sciences, and I do some pretty good measurement work. That's a big part of my background. There is a continuous record now. It goes back 3 to 4 years out of the 5 of the discovery, recording, and presenting of biological components within atmospheric samples, primarily by HEPA filter, but not exclusively that, also a method called electrostatic precipitation, and a repeated structure showing up over and over and over in a paper I put up just last week, did it again. So, not to take this out of context and say that, hey, this is everything, this is one of the 5, and actually soon I'm going to back up and we'll take the subject that people can deal with a little bit easier related to the environment. But it cannot be ignored if you truly wish to address the evidence that is available. So rather than get too deep into that without people having a background, I would suggest maybe that I back up a little bit and start with the beginning of this list related to environmental modification and control.
Okay, go ahead.
And how is such a thing possible? And it is based upon this. The evidence, I'm pretty patient in my ways, and I try to be conservative, I would say, and fair in my presentation. If I'm saying something now, it's because, at this level, it's because the data is pretty darn strong. And we can go over that in great detail if the person wants to. But there is clear evidence that a primary component of the aerosol operation...
Hold that thought for just a moment, and we'll be right back. Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and Clifford was saying that there's primary evidence that a specific or an important part of this whole spraying is... Go ahead.
Yes, there's clear evidence that a primary component of these aerosols involves the introduction of a metallic salt into the atmosphere, a very fine... very small metallic salt.
Now, is that an aluminum? What is the what metal is involved?
I'm going to list 5 metals. Like if we ever get the EPA doing their job, or the air quality folks doing theirs, there's 5 metals that I would suggest we start the test with. Actually, it's 6 now. The list would not be restricted to this, but it would be where I would say start your work here, because we have a large body of evidence that indicates these may be here. They are. barium, aluminum, titanium, magnesium, calcium, and a new one on the list is strontium. Now, there is a basis for these, but of those five, I am going to speak of two that I have identified with my sampling method over and over and over, and they are magnesium and barium. And of those two, there is a primary focus upon the element of barium. And of all of the testing that I've done, even though I would consider these other elements, in fact, strontium has many physical properties that are very similar to barium, but the amount of information that has been collected on barium is extremely strong now. One could conclude that with an extremely high degree of certainty, we know this exists in large quantities in the atmosphere.
Now, you're speaking in the atmosphere or in what is being sprayed into the atmosphere?
I'm sorry, Dr. Sands, please say again, please.
In other words, it doesn't ordinarily occur in the atmosphere. Are you suggesting
it is in
the atmosphere because of the spray?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a primary claim that I would make, and that is that there has been the systematic injection of massive amounts of metallic particles, metallic salts in particular, into our atmosphere, and we are dealing at a global level now. Now, if you start to look into the physical properties of this particular salt, barium salt, many interesting things come about. We can start with this. The forms of barium that we're speaking of, which would be the hydroxide forms, oxides and hydroxides, they absolutely love water. They soak up water in huge quantities, and there's a word they use called hygroscopic, meaning that it actually absorbs moisture from the air. These salts are of a hygroscopic nature, and this means they are soaking up the water, and the observations support what I am stating. One of the clearest patterns that has emerged is the advent of the operation preceding a storm front or moisture system. This has been reported by the thousands. Without question, I've done a lot of meteorological studies on it and show that this is clearly a pattern. So you have, at the easiest level, you have something which is basically sapping up that moisture out of the air. The second quality would be related to what they call specific heat. Not everything in the world heats up at the same rate. In fact, it all heats up differently. And so when you go sticking a frying pan or something in the sun, it heats up. And it heats up more than the air does. And there's been a major contradiction that has come about over time, and that is if you hear a certain theory that's been circulated widely about these operations, it is that, these things are actually very good for you. It's best that we don't talk about it. It's best that we don't tell you. But really, they're for your own good. And really what we're doing is we're saving the planet by counteracting global warming. I guess basically put up with that for about 3 years before I dug into it. And the data does not support that claim at all. And in fact, the data says exactly the opposite. And a couple of years ago, I basically stick my neck out there in all honesty that I can and say, hey, this doesn't fit. And if you actually look at what's going on, this metal causes this atmosphere to heat up. It does not cause it to cool down. And I stand by that conclusion, and it's based upon the principle of what's called specific heat. And the claim that I would make is that this material is both sapping up moisture and heating the air up. And the observations will support this. Now, if you start talking about environmental modification and control, you already have a major mechanism in place to completely alter the entire weather dynamics of this Earth and the ability of human beings to live. Because if you start affecting the moisture systems, your life is affected. Everything about us is affected if you start affecting moisture.
You mean what you're saying is that if they can control the water, they can control the people. Or if they can modify the supply of water, they can certainly control the people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's more advanced principles that can be involved with the salt. That would lead to the electrical properties of these salts. There are certain metals, there are certain elements that term is photoionized. What happens is there are certain elements that the energy within sunlight itself, it really surprised me when I first ran into it, the energy of sunlight alone, especially ultraviolet, but even some of the visible part of the spectrum, is sufficient to ionize certain salts. That's an amazing thing, because this means if you take certain elements, it's only certain elements, but if you expose them to this type of energy, which is ambient, it's up there all the time now, that these materials can ionize. This means they become electrically charged, which is what an ion is. So now you introduce another entire set of dynamics to this, which opens up a whole new avenue of discussion between us involving electromagnetic operations. Now, let's establish a case as to why I think this is true. And it has to do with that element. Barium is not just some casual element that's chosen accidentally. If you start stacking up all these physical properties, you have a pretty ideal specimen to accomplish a lot of things with a single usage. You have water absorption. You have a heat increase. You have high levels of toxicity. Barium, in my book on the air quality standards, barium is on the same level as arsenic. This stuff is highly toxic. Not anything to be dismissed. It's not just a metal. It's a highly toxic metal that has some very interesting and unusual physical properties. And barium happens to be an element that iron is one of those. There's only about, it's really about three. But they can ionize with the energy from sunlight. And that's a phenomenal thing, because that means even without the introduction of external energy from something we're doing, like HARP, which is another topic for us to discuss, that the ambient energy alone is enough to energize this medium, at least to some degree, such that the electromagnetic properties of that medium, this medium being the atmosphere, this is what we're talking about, are completely altered. And it doesn't take much. The ionosphere, many of us are familiar with, especially radio folks, the ionosphere is a layer above us roughly 60 miles, and it is an electrified layer. It is a charged layer, an ionized layer. That layer has less than 1% of the materials are electrically charged, and yet it completely alters the electrodynamic characteristics of that environment in a monumental way. I mean, go look at the history of radio and what happened there, and our use and discovery of that charged environment. What I'm suggesting to you is that this material, which has been positively identified, I mean, I'll stake my work on it best I can. I'm still looking for the professionals to come up and sign their names to basically do any work, let alone sign their names to it. But this material does exist in the atmosphere. And when you have a medium that now allows for electromagnetic properties to be, let's say, enhanced, and or extended and propagated, conceivably now from the ionosphere all the way down to the Earth, you have a whole different ball game going on. And there is a word called plasma, and I educate myself as I go along. I don't know everything. I teach myself and learn as I go along. When I first heard the word plasma, I said, oh boy, this is some kind of physics I'll never understand. I dug into it, and it's not that difficult at all in principle. A neon light tube, fluorescent light tube that all of us are familiar with, is an example of a plasma state. A plasma is an electrified gas, a charged gas. And a fluorescent light is nothing more than a tube that has this gas in it that will ionize. It will become electrically charged if it's subjected to energy. In this case, plug it into a wall. Imagine, conceptually, that the atmosphere itself has been modified such that it satisfies the properties, however weak, you know, there's different degrees, and it's all a matter of how many electrons are in there, but satisfies conceptually the principles and properties of a plasma state around the Earth itself.
So what would be the purpose of actually doing something of this sort and modifying our atmosphere and putting all this barium into the atmosphere?
Well, The easiest way I would describe it is this, and that is, if you have a medium that now allows for enhanced propagation of electromagnetic energy, then it means that it is easier, at the very least, it's easier, if not even just possible now, for you to send energy from point A to point B. You have a medium, you have an environment around you that you can't even tell, you can't even see. But it is a medium that allows propagation of energy in a way that it never did before.
Well, Tesla used to talk about the propagation of energy over long distance. He wanted to send electricity without electric wires. Is this something similar to what you're talking about?
Absolutely. It is exactly what I am speaking of. And Tesla is a very good example for us to lead into this topic of electromagnetic applications and to begin discussing HARP. Because when you say, why would somebody do this? Well, this is the principle. This is exactly what Tesla was about, was using the atmosphere as a medium for the transmission of energy. And he was dealing with, at least conceptually on his side, he was dealing with massive levels of energy.
Now, for our listeners out there, Nikola Tesla was a contemporary of Thomas Edison. He was also probably in the same mystical background. Edison was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky. Whether Tesla was or not, I don't know. But certainly he was brilliant, and he had actually come up with ideas of doing exactly what Clifford's talking about. He even built a plant there in New York many years ago to transmit electricity without wires. But, of course, that way anybody would be able to get the electricity. J.P. Morgan cut off his financing because he wanted to be able to sell the electricity. He didn't want to give it away. But obviously this has something to do with HARP. How would this tie into the High Altitude Auroral Research Project that we refer to affectionately as HARP?
In my case, the research leads me where I need to go. When HARP came up, you know, there were folks early in the game saying, hey, this is HARP going on, this is mind control. I could not give any importance to that statement. I just couldn't dismiss it, and I don't. But I paid no attention to it because I had no evidence, no basis to support anything. And that's the way I have to work. And what happened was, as I consider physically what I see around me, and am able to some degree, at least, to conceptualize what I believe makes sense from a physical standpoint, the research led me to HARP.
And of course, this is for our listeners out there who don't know. They take a billion watts of power and they focus it onto the ionosphere. There's a center, at least up in Alaska, we know of. There are probably several centers like this throughout the world. A research project, but it's so secret. They won't let us know because we're too common. Us common folks aren't smart enough to figure out what they're up to, or maybe we're smart enough to realize if we really knew what they were up to, we'd be extremely disturbed. Go ahead, then. How do you think it fits together, Clifford?
You know, HARP is claimed to be a research station, and indeed it may be a research station, but there is good reason to believe it may be accomplishing much more than research. The basic idea of HARP would be the introduction, the injection of energy into the ionosphere. Now remember, if you consider what I'm saying, looks like we may have an atmosphere that has now been modified such that it satisfies many of the properties that the ionosphere would have in terms of a certain now electron density allows for energy to transfer. So now, you know, that claim principle, research agenda, of studying the ionosphere, I actually have to extend to a broader range, including the atmosphere. But the primary focus of HARP is to introduce this energy into that ionosphere, generalized now to consider the term plasma environment, for the direction, manipulation, control, and propagation of that energy around the Earth.
Now, would you think this would be for weather control or what?
This could certainly be one. Now, let's go over some of those. I'll give you some examples of what exists within the HARP patent, and it is very difficult to deny a close correspondence between the physical data and testing and analysis that I have conducted, along with others, now over 5 years, and the principles and methods that are outlined in a patent by Bernard Eastland in 1987 that many people would certainly regard as a model or a blueprint for the HARP facility.
All right,
and I would agree with that, too.
Dr. Eastland designed HARP, And this would be the patent that he took out to protect his rights to it. So what did he say it was for?
Okay, here's about five or six things. I'll just go through them when we can come back. First of all, he'll reference Nikola Tesla right at the beginning of the patent. So we already have a historical tie with what we're speaking of. First would be Eastman talks about the injection of large amounts of barium for the very reason that I just spoke of, and that is that barium is a great thing for enhancing and increasing the electron density of a plasma. So we have a correspondence between what is being physically identified and the fundamental mechanism by which that medium is enhanced that's described in that in the Hart patent. Hart talks about using the magnetic field lines of the Earth as the medium for a propagation of energy. And there's a whole separate topic of research we haven't talked about, again, related to measurements that I've made, that do show the existence of what I would call unusual, unexplained, anomalous, ELF, extremely low frequency data, VLF data, and magnetic variations, Earth magnetic field variations. I have a body of data that is unusual, and the best source, the best way that I can describe this information coming from, it appears to be using the magnetic field lines of the Earth. This is what the data shows. So you have another level of correspondence between what is being measured, what is being observed, and the premises outlined within the Hart patent. I have probably about a half a dozen of these. Certainly the ionization topic is fundamental. That is increasing the electron density. The next would be the use of what's called cyclotronic resonance. Cyclotron resonance has many important considerations with the human body. A fellow named Robert Becker wrote a book called The Body Electric and Cross Currents, both of these books. And they talk about, at the cellular level, the role within the human body of cyclotron resonance. And what cyclotron resonance is, it's the revolving of an electron around a magnetic field line. Now, I know that sounds a little technical, but it's important because this, again, appears to be a mechanism that can be used and conceivably could well be affecting human beings. And this is done with ELF energy. Now, these frequencies of cyclotron resonance with the elements are occurring in the ELF frequency range. The ELF frequency range is the range of frequencies that our bodies work within.
And for our listener out there, ELF, extremely low frequency, right?
Right, we're talking, you know, 0 to 100 hertz.
And these, of course, do have physiological response on the human body and specifically on the human mind. So when you're dealing with these, well, you're dealing with something that can be used for psychological or other approaches, and it can affect not only the mind but the very functions of the body. So go ahead.
That's absolutely correct. Hart does talk about the use of ELF and VLF energy, and if you look in the executive summary for Hart from the Air Force, you'll see a curious phrase in there about the use of ELF energy to precipitate materials from the atmosphere. Now, what this means to me, I mean, someone else can give their interpretation, but it means basically the dropping, the lowering of particulate matter in the atmosphere towards the ground. And ELF energy is described as the method by which this can be done. So we've already talked about having the particulates in the air. Within the executive summary, you have a mechanism for actually directing those particulates towards a desired goal or target with the use of ELF energy.
Well, you know, we're just about out of time. We could go for about another 3 hours and probably not get to the second or third item, but we're going to have to let you go. Will you be willing to come back again some evening and explore this further? I think it's fascinating, and certainly I think fascinating that you have gone to the patent for HARP. Everybody wonders what it's about, and I'm sure that they probably put it right there in the patent, didn't they?
It's pretty darn clear.
Is it up on your website?
You know, it should be, Dr. Van. I don't want to. It certainly should be, but unless I found it on here, I'm not going to say. I'll say this, it won't be hard to find.
All right, how would they get it?
Bernard Eastman, Hart Patton will not be hard to find on the net if I don't have it.
All right, fine. We're going to have to let you go, but I want to thank you so very much for being with us. I guess it's been Clifford kind of coming, and of course, you've just got a sample of what you're going to hear at the Conspiracy Conference, and you'll have a chance to meet Clifford over there. That's the 29th and 30th of this month over in Santa Clara, and if you want to know more about it, the telephone number to call is 209-832-0999. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Bye-bye.
Dan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed the program. I think this is fascinating material. A lot of things I hadn't heard before. Of course, I've known that there was barium was up there before. But this idea, of course, creating a plasma medium for the transfer of energy is indeed a very, very fascinating aspect of this. Clifford's put a lot of time in, and we have a four-tape set on chemtrails. If you'd like to get a copy of this interview this evening, why, it will be available through Radio Liberty by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, or certainly our four-tape set on chemtrails is available as well. So this is the time when we just have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do 5 hours of talk radio a day, trying to tie together everything that's going on in the world. There are evil men in the world. There are evil men who are experimenting on the population of this country and the rest of the world. What happened was back in about 1640, a group of occultists, of Satanists, came to America. And this is covered in a book called The Secret Destiny of America, written by Mandy P. Hall, who himself was a Satanist. And in this story, he tells how Francis Bacon had sent this small group to take over control of America so that one day America's power and could be used to force the entire world into this, the mold of ancient Atlantis. In other words, we were to reconstitute lost Atlantis, and America would lead the whole world into this new utopian New World Order and New World Religion. Of course, Manly P. Hall didn't talk about the New World Religion, but he worshipped a different god. His god was Satan. And the people who worship Satan, why do they worship Satan? Why, he doesn't put any barriers on what you do. The god that we worship says, thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not kill, and thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not bear false witness. And a lot of people feel that he's a killjoy, a cosmic killjoy. What they want is absolute freedom. But absolute freedom leads to absolute anarchy as well. So our plea to you is, if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family and help us, as 5 hours a day we try to bring out what's really behind everything that's going on today. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can listen either directly or indirectly to our programs 5 hours a day. The first morning program on AmericaNewsNet.com, and that's AmericaNewsNet.com, the American Freedom Network website, Genesis, GCNLive.com, or GCN on, GCN, I believe it's online.com, for the second and third hours, and of course the last 2 hours on Radio Liberty. In fact, the last 3 hours you can hear on Radio Liberty is broadcast both by Genesis and our own network. We hope, if many of you out there will want to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which goes into the spiritual battle. That's The Brotherhood of Darkness book. We have so many other items, The Pagan Agenda, Satanism Revealed, Satanism and Deliverance. We have Aleister Crowley and his friends. You're going to get the material from Radio Liberty. You're just not going to get from other sources, because most people don't want to talk about the Masonic influence, the Rosicrucian influence, Theosophical Society, the Lucius Trust, used to be the Lucifer organization. In fact, I take their publications regularly. They tell you there's a hierarchy that rules the world. If you don't believe it, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Just ask for the pamphlet on the spiritual hierarchy put out by the Luciferian movement in America today. They're proud of it. They figure the average individual is just too dumb to be able to recognize who's really running the world and why we're being plunged into a prolonged and horrible and bloody war. And that's really what was going on over there with the atrocity stories you're hearing, just to inflame the mob. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring, because we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for the few minutes, because we have with us on the line, coming from, Gus Stelzer. Gus is formerly an executive for General Motors, and at one time he was in charge of sales on the West Coast. How large an organization did you have working for you at that time, Gus?
Well, in the last 10 years I was with GM, I had 2,100 people on my own payroll, and then I was in charge of over 1,000 dealers, mostly in the western half of the country, with another 35,000 employees, all of whom my organization had to train and manage and make sure that the 1,000 dealers maintained a profitable business and got proper market share and handle all the lawsuits that went with it.
And, of course, General Motors was a great company at that time. Is that they used to say that what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Well, the statement has been twisted. Engine Charlie Wilson appeared before a congressional committee, and he was asked what his opinion was with regard to the relationship of General Motors and America. And he said, what is good for America is good for GM and vice versa.
Right.
But the press picked it up, and they twisted it, and they said what is good for GM is good for America.
Okay, so it's really what's good for
America. What Engine Charlie Wilson said. And it's been gone down in history since then. That was back in the late 1950s, and that erroneous statement is still being repeated.
All right, well, I'm glad you clarified that for us. But certainly General Motors was one of the major engines of our economy. And, of course, the automobile, both General Motors and Ford, Chrysler, they produced a lot of products. They had a lot of jobs. They were sort of equated with America. America was a wonderful nation where you could have a home and a car, or maybe even two cars. In fact, that's always sort of been the objective. You know, what Hoover said, the two cars in every garage and a chicken in every pot. And, of course, after the Depression came, it was two chickens in every garage. But certainly at one time, the car was the foundation of much of our economy.
Well,
what we're going to talk this evening about what's happening as far as NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, tearing down our tariff boundaries, and this myth of free trade, that somehow free trade is going to stimulate our economy, that we've got all these people over in China we can sell to, all those people in Mexico we can sell to, and if we just, are willing to have this closing down of many of our industries or having them leaving this country, we're going to have all sorts of new jobs here, and the good times are going to roll under free trade. So you want to pick up the story from there, Gus?
Well, yes, Dr. Stan and your listeners, just in a capsule, there is no such thing as free trade. Certainly there is not within the United States. We are not a free market economy. Every dollar of production and commerce in this country is saturated with the tremendous costs of federal, state, and local regulations and tax burdens, all of which account for about 80% of the cost of the average American product. So there is no free trade within the United States. That's a delusion that's being held by many people that think we're a free enterprise and so on. That's a lot. That just isn't true. I mean, if you're just a homeowner and you don't pay your property taxes, pretty soon you'll find out that you don't own your home anymore. Now when it comes to commerce across our borders, I think honest people will generally acknowledge that every participant in a competitive activity should play by the same rules. For example, if you're sitting at a table at a poker game in Las Vegas and the dealer says it's a five-card draw and a $100 ante, nobody is allowed to enter the game and reach for the jackpot with only a $5 or a $10 ante. There's only one activity, only one competitive activity in which the rules are not the same for every participant. Even though the lives of millions of people and trillions of dollars are involved, and that is within this arena of free trade, because we have a double standard that we allow stuff to come in from other countries into this country that are made under conditions that violate practically every American law and every tax law. And we have a sad situation where we have legislators, especially at the federal level, who pass all kinds of laws which have a cost consequence, and then they turn around and invite foreigners to send their products in this country in violation of the very laws that they passed before. So when you get to the bottom line on this whole issue, what we are confronted with is a terrible breakdown in moral comprehensions. It is morally wrong to engage in free trade across our borders, which has the effect of double-crossing honest, law-abiding people in this country and putting millions of people out of work. And since 1971, I have documented that over 40 million Americans have lost their jobs because of our trade policies, and the list of damages that has gone on. As a matter, in 1971, for example, we had a national debt of only $408 billion. Now, I say only, that's quite a bit, but that was after some 190-some-odd years in which we were operating since the Constitution was drafted. But since that time, we've added nearly $7 trillion of national debt, and so we now have a national debt that the last figures I had is about $7.2 or $7.3 trillion, and 95% of all of that national debt is due to our trade policies. So this is really a tragic thing, not only from the standpoint of numbers and dollars, but also a tragedy with respect to what it has done to the American people.
I mean, one of the things that really disturbs me is we hear all this about equitable trade or free trade or fair trade, I think is that the term that they use, but other countries are looking after their vested interests. Other countries are going to block our imports coming in and competing with theirs. And they're not allowing our cars to go into Japan. They're not allowing our cars to go into China. They can always find some bureaucratic problem or bureaucratic justification for making to come in. I think we sold something like maybe 60 General Motors cars in China that were manufactured in the United States, but large numbers of Chinese cars now are coming into the United States because we don't have any barriers to keep them out. We're welcoming all these imports because they're cheap, and yet, of course, our exports are certainly not meeting the anywhere near like our imports, and that's why we are going to have a export deficit of about $500 billion this year, about $500 billion, $500 trillion more that we are importing than we're exporting, and because the other countries are looking after their country, they're looking after their people, it would appear that our leaders have a different agenda, and that is to redistribute the wealth of the middle class of America.
Well, what's involved here, Stan, is a question of sovereignty and maintaining control of our own destinies. When, after the Constitution was ratified, in the very first Congress, they passed laws to establish what was called the tariff system. And for all of the years of that 19th century through the 1800s, tariffs on our imports furnished about 85% of the revenue needed to run our federal government. And during those roughly 123 years up to 1910, there were about four or five occasions when the free traders attempted to depart from the tariff system, and whenever they did, the economy worsened. So they went back to what was called the tariff protectionist system, and the economy improved. And that's a matter of record that's well documented. I have several books that describe that. But then in 1913, President Wilson was conned into abandoning that tariff system to provide the revenue for the government. They abandoned the tariffs on imports, and they put a tariff on American goods. Now, when I say tariff on American goods, that might be a statement that's hard to understand, but we have to understand that an income tax is a tariff.
I see. Now, is that the beginning of the corporate taxes here in the United States?
That was in 1913,
right,
when there were corporate taxes as well as individual taxes, and the taxes at that time were only 2% and on a small percentage of the individual population. And in 1910, before the income tax law was passed, the per capita tax burden in this country was only $6.95. That's federal, state, and local. And a couple of years ago, that tax burden has sailed past $10,500 per capita. And all of that is a tariff.
Well, you know, I think it was so clever what they did. You know, when they were passing the income tax, they said, oh, this is only for the very wealthy. These people who have so much money, and why shouldn't they share just a little of their money with the poor people who need it so much, and think how much it would help the poor people. And we're not going to put a limit on the amount of the taxes, because if we were to put a limit, it would probably go up to, say, 3% if we put a limit on 3%. So we'll keep it far less than that. But this is the only equitable thing to do. And with this idea of taxing the rich, you know, this politics of envy, they sold this to the American people, who never understood that this was never intended for the wealthy. It was always intended as a vehicle of controlling the middle class. And this is exactly where it is today. The very poor don't pay any taxes. The very rich have means of getting around paying the taxes and passing it on to future generations through setting up trust and all. And it's primarily a tax on the middle class, which, of course, is increasingly being impoverished. And, of course, on the corporations as well. But, of course, many of our major corporations just don't bother to pay any taxes, especially if they move overseas. Why, they're exempted for paying taxes here in the United States. Isn't that nice? It's almost as if we are subsidizing our major corporations to move overseas.
Well, Stan, I have a kind of a view on this. I believe that if we're going to be a sovereign nation, we ought to act like one, and we ought to control our own destinies. I don't quarrel with other countries putting up barriers or putting up tariffs on the stuff that we try to export to them. I think that's the duty of a government to control and regulate the imports that come into their country.
Of course it is, but those countries are looking after their economies and their people. Our leaders have no loyalty to this country. They seem to have a loyalty to this globalist dream.
That's because our political people under the control of the Wall Street crowd and the financial people. They have lost control of our own destinies. For example, there's been a lot of criticism of China recently about things that they're doing wrong as a result of this $124 to $130 billion trade deficit we've got going with them. And so we've got Secretary of Treasury John Snow putting the pressure on them to devalue their currency. Now, that's a cop-out. We have the right to establish a tariff on Chinese goods coming into this country. And if we think there's some imbalance or something wrong with the pricing of products from China coming into this country, we ought to impose a tariff on it to make up the difference. Now, the fact that we don't is a de facto acknowledgement by our own government that they have lost control of our country. We have the right to establish the tariff. And that's the way it was for the first 123 years after the Constitution was drafted. But we have totally abandoned the duty and responsibility in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, I think it's Clause 3, that Congress is supposed to regulate commerce with foreign nations in order to form a more perfect union, as is spelled out in the preamble. But they're not doing that. Somebody said that we have a parliament of whores in Washington, and I think that's about how sad our situation has become. If we have time here, Stan, there is a development that occurred yesterday that I think indicates just how sickening the leadership of our country has become, and that involved a talk made by Alan Greenspan. Have you heard of that?
No, why don't you tell us about that? I've been on the road for the last couple of days, so I haven't been able to keep up with the news.
Do you have a minute?
Sure, you got about 4 minutes.
Okay, well, yesterday, Thursday, Alan Greenspan gave a talk over satellite to a group of banking people out of a conference that was scheduled out of the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago. And the basic headline out of it was that the headline, and this comes from an Associated Press dispatch that I'm looking at here right now. It said, Greenspan says the bill for soaring deficits will soon come due. And then the words were, he said, America's soaring federal budget deficit represents a major obstacle to long-term U.S. economic stability. Then he went on to say that he cautioned against being lulled into a false sense of security about the deficit or America's low savings rate or the nation's trade deficit just because these problems have not yet triggered rising interest rates or a steep fall in the value of the dollar. Well, now right there he has made a terrible mistake. The value of the dollar has already declined 40% against the euro. It's declined 25% against the Japanese yen. And on a, what they call a trade-weighted basis, it's down about 25% of all the nations that we trade with. So he's brushing aside the declining value of our dollar, and we have to understand that the primary reason for the declining value of our dollar is that we are flooding the world with $500 billion of our dollars last year and this year, and we're doing it at a rate again next year in a form that's called a trade deficit. And a trade deficit is a forfeiture of production, which is the only thing that creates wealth and tax revenue. At the same time, it's a forfeiture of our currency. It's a double whammy. We lose both ways, coming and going. And yet, Mr. Greenspan says that the trade deficit doesn't worry him. And he made a statement, something to the effect that the imbalances haven't reached a point yet where the free lunch is still to be invented. We've been on a free lunch program in this country for at least 50 years. And the free lunch program, if I could describe it, is basically this. As a result of millions of regulatory laws and tax laws that are the result of demands by the electorate And the legislators passed these laws, which create all of these great costs. So we have a nice country, and the state of California certainly is typical of that. And so after all these costs are imposed on the American working people and American producing industries, the American people are encouraged to not pay for it at the consumer counter. And I liken this to walking into a very fancy restaurant, you could call it a Ritz-Carlton, and having a gourmet lunch, and it's a lovely place, everything is fine, but then you walk out without paying for it. And so we've been on a free lunch program now for some 50 years, and every year the trade deficit situation gets worse.
Well, now, what did Alan Greenspan suggest that needed to be done?
Yeah,
he wants to cut the massive budget deficit, or that he's not so concerned about the trade deficit, but he is concerned about the budget deficit?
Well, he has two things. Number one, he has no concern about the trade deficit, and he says in his remarks, he says, that will be corrected by market forces. That's a lot of baloney. This man knows better than that.
Well, I know he does.
He can't think any better than that. He ought to resign from his office in the Federal Reserve. And the reason I say that is, I'm looking at a chart here right now.
You're going to have to hold that thought, Gus, because we've got to go to a break. But we'll be right back in just a moment with Gus Delzer, former executive with General Motors, with tremendous responsibility. But now he's trying to warn the American people about a disastrous financial course. Well, our guest this evening is Mr. Gus Delzer, and right now, while many of our stations are not tuned into us, we're just going to continue this conversation. You were saying that you have a chart there going into the background of the implications of this massive trade deficit?
My chart, it's rather crude, but it covers a 58-year span, and it begins in the first year after World War II, when we went back into production again. And it covers 29 years from 1946 through 1974. During that time, cumulatively in 29 years, we enjoyed an $87 billion trade surplus. And what started out in 1946 as a budget deficit, I mean not a budget deficit, but a national debt of just $271 billion, it rose only $226 billion to $486 billion, but by the end of 1974. So those 29 years were fairly good. But it was in the latter part of those 21 years, in 1971, which President Nixon had to abandon the Bretton Woods Monetary Accord, which turned our currency values over to central banks and currency speculators. So then we take the next 29 years from 1975 to the year of 2003, as I have it on my chart. In 1975, we had a trade deficit of $809 billion. By 1982, it was up to $36 billion.
It would be a trade deficit not of $800 billion. It was trade deficit of
$8.9
billion.
$8.9 billion in 75.
Right. Okay.
It went to 36.5 in 82. By 87, it went up to $159 billion. By 1995, it was $174 billion. By 1998, it hit $247 billion. 99, it was $346 billion. In 2000, it was $452 billion. In 2002, it was $482 billion, and last year it was $525 billion. Now, as I look at this chart, and I put alongside of that the budget deficits, every year, as this chart, the trade deficits increased, so did our budget deficits. They run in virtual tandem. And as a result, without going through all the numbers by year on budget deficits, we went from a $541 billion national debt in 1975 to where it is now $7.2 trillion. So when Alan Greenspan says the trade deficit will cure itself by market forces, that I can't imagine anybody making such an irresponsible statement. It has never happened.
Well,
he ought to know why. The problem with Mr. Greenspan is that he's a numbers cruncher, and he doesn't understand the relationship of numbers to people and how this affects people. When you have a $525 billion trade deficit, you're talking about the forfeiture of 20 million jobs in this country, and you're forfeiting all the tax revenue that might be generated with that kind of employment in this country.
In other words, if we were not running this deficit, if we were producing the goods here rather than buying from overseas, you're thinking there'd be 20 million additional jobs?
That's right. And one of the things that really irritates me is...
Hold just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Gus Stelzer, former executive with General Motors, and he was saying that with the massive deficits we're running, if we were producing the goods here in the United States, instead of, importing these products from overseas, there would be an additional 20 million jobs here in the United States. But you see, that isn't the agenda of the elitists who are running this. They want, of course, to redistribute our wealth. They're doing a great job. The one thing is they're not letting the American people know that there is an agenda, there is a plan there. If you haven't read it, it's called The Earth Charter. You need to get it. As Gorbachev said, that great paragon of virtue, Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, this is the new Ten Commandments for the world. And it talks about redistributing the wealth between nations. That's what we're doing. Redistributing our jobs, our wealth, to the rest of the world, and gradually impoverishing our people. So pick up the story there.
Well, this is a situation that just cannot continue on. Greenspan is right in setting up an alarm signal about our soaring budget deficits and the national debt, which at the rate we're going, we're going to have a national debt of about something over $8 trillion next year. And if we think there's a decline in respect for the value of the dollar now, it's going to get worse as we flood the world with more of our trade deficit dollars, which have the effect of causing budget deficits. And then the real ironic thing about this, currently, the last figures I've had, is that foreign countries have slapped about $1.5 trillion worth of mortgages on our federal treasury, and they euphemistically call it T-bills or treasury securities. And some people are saying, isn't it wonderful that the foreign people are so nice that they're helping us finance our debt?
In other words, what you're saying is about $1.6 trillion of America's national debt is now held by foreign interests and foreign governments.
Well, And some of the people in our own government in Washington and the people on Wall Street and the so-called economic and financial experts are saying this is good. It's a nice friendly gesture on the part of the foreign countries to do this. But what they're not telling us is that we gave them the money in the first place. These are our trade deficit dollars that are coming back. And when we send our dollars to foreign countries, they have to make some decisions as to what they're going to do with those dollars. Prior to 1971, when the Bretton Woods Accord was in place, and when foreigners felt that they had too many dollars, they could cash them in at our treasury at a rate of $35, and they'd get an ounce of our gold. But because we were on the verge of forfeiting all of our gold reserves, that was when Nixon departed from the international gold standard. So now the foreigners have all of these dollars and the question of what to do with them. So what they're doing with them, among other things I've just mentioned, they've put over $1.5 trillion of mortgages on our treasury, and at current rates of somewhere around 5% that we're paying them $75 billion a year in interest to get our own money back. This would be like a homeowner who doesn't have a mortgage on his house, and he decides, well, I don't need all the money I got here. I'm going to give the bank maybe a couple of $100,000, and as a result, pretty soon the homeowner finds that he hasn't got enough money to maintain his house. So he goes to his friendly banker, and the banker says, "Yeah, we'll lend you back some of the money you gave us, the $200,000, but we want a 6 or 8% interest on it." That's how dumb our trade policies and our financial policies are. These are our dollars to begin with, and we lost all of the values that would come from production. Adam Smith made some very definite statements that all wealth is created by production, that is, the labor of people. Frederick Bastiat in 1850 wrote a little book called The Law, and he said the same thing, that everything begins with labor. And when we forfeit labor in this country, we are forfeiting income, we're forfeiting wealth, and we're forfeiting tax revenue. And that's why we have these horrendous budget deficits in the national debt.
One of the points you make, which I think is so very important, is that for every a person who's employed in production here in the United States, why, of course, you'll get a compounding effect from that, and there'll be three or four other people in support industries.
Absolutely.
So one manufacturing job may actually produce, what, two or three other jobs?
Oh, I would say in general manufacturing, it'll run somewhere between 4 to 7 total jobs.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Mr. Gus Delzer. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Gus Delzer, former executive with General Motors. And we're talking about what's happening as far as our trade deficit is concerned. And Mr. Delzer believes that our current trade policies of NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization are really suicidal policies, because what's happening is we're sending our wealth overseas, that people are coming back, they're buying our bonds with us, then we have to pay them interest on the money they've loaned us to buy the bonds, that it was our money to begin with. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, in addition to foreign people having our trade deficit dollars to use to put mortgages and buy T-bills that our federal government then has to pay taxes on, and we Americans have to do that. If you were to do some little bit of that mathematics and figure that we're sending foreigners about $75 billion a year as the interest on the mortgages that they have on the federal treasury, and then divide that by about 100 million households in this country, you're looking at the average household is having to pay about $750 to foreigners in order to get our own money back. But it goes beyond just the degree to which the foreign trade deficit dollars are coming back. They're also buying up our factories, our real estate, and so on. And one of the most egregious comments was made by President Bush a few weeks ago when he was in Ohio, and he was trying to defend himself on the loss of about 250,000 jobs in Ohio since he became president. And he talked about the Honda plant at Marysville, Ohio, that they employed some 6,000 people or some such number, and that this was a good thing. But what President Bush didn't say is that Honda acquired that plant with our dollars. They own that plant, and all of the I'd say 50% of the parts that go into the assembly of a Honda coming out of Marysville, Ohio, are made in Japan, and that further worsens our trade deficit. In addition to that, they are not paying the normal scale that was paid to American automobile workers. This was confirmed to me just 2 days ago when I was on your program on another network. I received a call from someone in Michigan, asked me if I knew about the latest union contract with General Motors.
Hold that thought. We'll just be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Gus Stelzer, who is a former executive at General Motors. And we're talking about the fact that the one of the Honda plants, in fact, I think we're talking more about the General, is this the General Motors contract that you're speaking of, or is this the Honda contract?
He called me about the General Motors contract.
All right. Why don't you explain this new contract, which is aimed at exactly what I've been talking about for some time, and that is there is a plan afoot to gradually lower the living standards of the American worker by gradually lowering his wages. I mean, how can we possibly compete with China, where their people will work there for $100 a month, when our workers are getting, maybe $150 to $175 a day of working here, $20 an hour, something like that. So what is the what is actually happening with this new General Motors contract, which I believe bodes very, very poor for the future living standards of the people of this country?
Well, to begin with, the contract with the big three American car makers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, of course, were developed over a period of many years going back to 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was formed. And throughout all of those years, the federal government, through the National Labor Relations Board and other factions of our government, sided with the labor organization to put continual pressure on employers, especially in the auto industry, to raise wages and improve the working standards. But to bring it up to currently, General Motors has a lot of people that have been with them a long, long time. They're now perhaps in their 50s. They're hoping for some retirement. And their base pay, on average, is $25 an hour, in addition to which they get some fringe benefits that probably add another $5 or $6 to the labor cost.
That would be health costs. That would be pension, retirement, things like
that's
that.
Right.
Disability,
that's
right.
But now the new plan is that all new workers, their base scale is not going to be $25 like other people working in the plant. It's going to be $15 an hour. And they will get get less in the way of medical coverage, limited retirement plan, if any, severance allowances will be reduced. Now, the point of this that I believe anyone can understand, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand this, that somebody making now $15 an hour is not going to be paying taxes to support our government like somebody making $25 an hour. And therein lies another facet of this problem of our rising national debt and our rising federal budget deficits. And this isn't just one incident that I've described here of a recent GM contract. It's going on all over the country, not only in revisions of pay scales, but also in the decision of corporations to shut down their factories in this country and move offshore. I had an occasion in early 1982. I was then retired from GM and had been for 6 years. I retired from them in 1976. I was able to learn about a very devious tax kickback scheme that Japan was running, whereby they kicked back as much as 30% of the taxes that they had imposed on their Japanese manufacturers, including automobile companies like Honda and Toyota. And if they exported it to this country, they would get the 30% back so that they could sell their cars far cheaper in this country than in their own country. And conversely, if an American company wanted to export its cars over to Japan, they would have to pay between 22 and 30% inbound customs tax, thereby raising the tax even higher, raising the price even higher than it was in the United States.
And so Japan has never been honest or straightforward as far as their tariffs are concerned. They've always put the barriers to keep out our products. They've always done everything they could to encourage exporting to us, because they're interested in maintaining the stability of their society, and the people in Washington, D.C. are interested in undermining the fabric of ours.
The point of the little story, let me try to get to the point. I uncovered this thing. I developed the 59 pages of documentary on how this thing functions, and I sent it in to then Secretary of Commerce Malcolm Baldrige, the United States Trade Representative William E. Block. I received confirmation from him that this is exactly what is happening, but they were not going to do anything about it. So I sent it in to a fellow, the man that I had worked with very closely before retiring. His name was Jim McDonald. He was the head of the Chevrolet division at that time when I retired. And when I called him in 1982 and sent him a copy of this documentation, he was then the president of General Motors. And he was shocked to learn what was going on. Over a period of about 6 months, there were efforts made through GM management, vice presidents, and Jim McDonald himself to get Washington to change his plan and to call Japan's hand on it. And I had correspondence from them and telephone calls and thought that things were going fine. And one day I got a letter, three lines long, from Jim McDonald saying that they had to abandon any further pursuit of this project. About 3 or 4 days after that, I got a telephone call from him in which he asked me if I got the letter. And I said, yes, I did. I don't understand it. What's going on? And he said, we had been told from the very top level of the United States government, and this is 1982, so it could be none other than Ronald Reagan, that the Washington is setting policies, foreign policies, in the Pacific and the far Pacific, not General Motors, and General Motors is advised to bug off and get out of this thing. And so I said to Jim McDonald, what's going to be done? You're already in a position where you're losing money in the corporation because of the Japanese invasion. This is going to be the death knell of General Motors and Ford and every other car maker and all of the other companies that provide supplies to GM and so on, and the ripple effect, it'll be disastrous. And Jim McDonald says, I don't know really what can be done, and these are about his exact words. He says, I can't sleep at nights about this thing. But he says, if our own government will not support us, we're law-abiding people, and if they're going to undermine us with products coming in that evade our laws, and we will have no other recourse other than to shut down every plant in this country and move it offshore so we can get cheap labor, too. And in that way, that's the only way we're going to survive.
Maybe that's what it was all about.
The stand there was 1982. Since then, General Motors has shut down about 50 plants in this country. Many of them have moved to Mexico. GM is now the biggest employer in Mexico. And a lot of people are very critical of General Motors and other companies we're moving offshore, but I think we have to understand that it was the crooked politicians in our government that caused this. They forced American industry to do this or they would go bankrupt.
Sure. Well, I think that this is true with many of our industries, and I think some of the industries don't want to do what they're doing, but they have to do it
to survive.
Because it is the official policy of the American government to actively encourage our industries to move offshore. This is not accidental. This is not a foolish policy. This is what it's really all about. And I've been studying this now for not quite as long as you have, but at least for 15 years. And I've seen this pattern laid out where I remember many years ago there was a gentleman who had a frozen food factory, a packing plant over here in Watsonville. He told me that he could move and go to Mexico. They would give him half the money to set up a plant down there. They would lend him the rest of the money at 3% interest to compete against himself. He said, I can't compete against that. They can buy their produce cheaper there. They can buy hire their people cheaper. There's no way we can compete with Mexico when our government is subsidizing the establishment of frozen food packing plants in Mexico. That's what it's really all about. But you see, we can't let the American people realize that some people in our government have a different agenda.
Well, this whole thing goes back. You and I have talked before on other programs of the declining morality of our country. And I think this is really the most serious problem we have in America, where our nation and the majority of people, and it isn't just the politicians or the corporations or the financial people, but everybody seems to have gravitated to the idea that if we can get by and save a dime here or there, it doesn't matter any, they lost total respect for this country and its product. When I see people driving a Lexus Japanese-made car, 100% Japanese-made, and they have a flag flying off of it, I almost have to regurgitate. I have to ask this fella, whereas the flag is something supposed to reflect our allegiance to America, I have to ask him, to what country does he have his, this owner of this Japanese car, to whom does he have his allegiance? I was in the debate in 1998 in St. Louis against a member of the Wall Street Journal staff by the name of James Bovard, who had written a book about the fair trade fraud. And it was a deluxe affair with the cocktails and dinner, dress-up affair. About 150 prominent people of St. Louis were there. And we had a regular schedule of debating back and forth over some, and we had a final arrangement whereby each of us would make a final statement. My statement was this. I said, Mr. Bovard, I have read your book, and in it you have shed crocodile tears about factories that have closed in Cambodia, in Thailand, in Vietnam because of our restrictive trade policy. But I don't recall reading anywhere in your book any tears or any concern about the millions of jobs that have been lost as a result of your globalism free trade policy. So I have a question for you. To what country do you owe your allegiance? That was the end of the debate. 150 people stood up and cheered and clapped, and Mr. Bovard left through a back door. That was the end of the debate.
All right, well,
I got a letter the other day from Phyllis Schlafly. I think you've heard of her.
I know Phyllis very well. She's a personal friend.
Head of the Eagle Forum. She was one of the first. She rushed up to me and threw her arms around my shoulders, and she whispered in my ear, she said, "You slaughtered him."
Yes, I love Phyllis. She's a very special lady.
And this is five years later. I got a note from him. It says, I well remember the debate where you slaughtered Mr. Bovard.
Well, let's tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book. It's The Nightmare of Camelot. And because this is a very important book. There's a new edition, I think, eight new pages in the front. But it's the classic book on what's wrong with these policies that we're following.
Well, so the book is now in soft cover, so it's a lot cheaper than the hardback that came out a few years ago. It's 375 pages plus an introductory by me to bring things up to date. And it could be obtained the price is $12 on the book, and then there's $2.95 for shipping and handling, or $14.95. It's about the cheapest book you can get on the market, and it's probably the most informative book on economics and the way we're going in this country financially. There's a couple of ways that can be obtained. I have an email address, and on the previous program, I think we got mixed up and I gave somebody the wrong email address. My email address is my name, Gus Stelzer, GUSSTELZER, and then there's the...
Now that's Gus Stelzer at what...
Then there's the app.
But I mean, what are you at? Are you at AOL.com or what?
At AOL.
At AOL.com, okay.
And then at AOL.com. So it's Gus Stelzer at AOL.com.
Okay, fine.
That's my email address. Now, I have a toll-free telephone number. It's run through NCI, and I get an extension from their normal 800 lines. And here is the number that people can call. I've already had several calls from previous programs with you. It's 1-800 and then 484-9527-1078. Those last four numbers are the extension numbers.
All right. Then we'll read it once more. That's 800-484-9527. 1078. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Hi. Very interesting and talk to people who are knowledgeable and who've been up at the higher levels in our economy. And my question is, what's investors feeling about whether the housing market is going up or if it's going to crash? Because obviously the guys behind the scenes will direct it in whichever direction suits them at the time.
All right.
I'm sure I can hear you too well.
Well, the basic question is, Jim wants to know what's going to happen as far as real estate prices. Are they going to go up? Or are they going to go down? Because he says he feels that this whole thing will be manipulated by the people working behind the scenes to their advantage. So do you think there's going to be a real estate bubble, or are the prices just going to continue going up forever?
Well, there are several things in the mill. For the last month or two, the stock market, look at that first, the Dow, has been vacillating. And if you draw the trend line, the trend line is down. It perked up as a result of the crash between 2000 and 2002 when $8 trillion was lost in the market, and it kind of bound back, and the Dow was up around 10,800, something like that, about 4, 5, 6 months ago. Now today, the Dow had another loss of 124 points, and it's down to 10,117, and the Nasdaq, which at one time was up around 5,200, and which fell all the way back down about 1,100 about a year ago, it had some rebound, and it was up around 2,200 a couple of months ago, and now it went down again another 20 points today, and it's down at 1,918. So what the market is doing by telling us it may have a day in which there is improvement in the stock market, it is followed by another couple of days in which it's going down. So there's a lack of confidence in the way the stock market is going. And not that I believe that the stock market is a bellwether of everything, but then when we get back to the real estate thing, the declining value of our dollar as a result of flooding the world with our trade deficit dollars can't have any effect other than inflation. And the Federal Reserve, through Alan Greenspan, has already indicated that there will be some increases in interest rates. As the interest rates start to rise, we're going to have a reversal of the real estate bubble. How serious that will be, it's hard to say. But it could be a very, very serious one. And and that being the case, I don't believe we should be careless and reckless about the other policies that we have, and to allow a continuation of our trade policies as they are, which are undermining the value of our dollar. Another report today was that the price of OPEC oil now is over $40 a barrel. That's a new high, all-time high. And when people are complaining about the price of gasoline, they haven't seen anything yet. The price of gasoline, the rise in price, is not due to some shenanigans going on in the oil companies. The oil company profits are rather marginal. If you want to blame anybody, you got to blame the banking industry and the investment people. Their profit margins are about three times higher than they are in the oil industry, but they're going to have to get their recovery of the increasing prices on oil. And the oil is going to be dictated by foreign forces who see our dollar declining in value because of our trade deficit policies. We're flooding the world with our dollars. You know, there's a
as far as the price of the housing, do you think that as the interest rates go up, the prices of the houses will eventually start to drop?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So you're suggesting that if this bubble starts to go, we could have some real problems.
Dan, I'm almost. You see, when I was 14 years old in October 1929.
You remember that?
I remember the crash. I remember all of the 10 years of the Great Depression. It was a terrible time, and we are headed in that same direction.
Well, I was born in February of 1929, so I don't remember too much of it. I do remember about 1933.
But I remember. Here's another thing that, because of I've lived through all of this. I lived through all of the 20s, and I was a good student in school. I graduated from the Missouri Business School in St. Louis, where I studied accounting, commercial law, and so on. I was 14 years old and got the diploma for that. And so I worked as the only steady wage earner in our family. My father was out of work most of the time because of the Depression. 25% of the working people in the country were without a job by 1934-1935, and that's a figure that is really astounding when you recognize that in those years the mothers and the wives really didn't work. The husband and the man in the house was the breadwinner, and he was without a job. And so it was a tough time. But even during the great troubles of the Great Depression, we were a civil people. There was hardly a day that would go by that we didn't have someone knocking at our back door, not our front door, but on our back door, pleading for something to eat, just a half a sandwich or a slice of bread. That's how tough things were. Every day this happened.
Well, I remember, and I remember they used to mark little mark on the door if you gave them something, so the next person would know that these were people who would help you.
Yeah. But still, you could walk the streets, even at night, everywhere. Was no fear of being mugged or being assaulted by anybody. We were a civil society. We're no longer a civil society. If we ever have another economic breakdown anywhere close to what happened in the 1930s, I hesitate to think what's going to happen to this country.
Well, Jim,
it isn't going to be pleasant.
I agree with everything you're saying, Gus. Jim, does that answer your question?
I think after the immigration, they're all going to be fighting for a piece of whatever is left. We cannot take our economic policy too lightly. We're definitely on the wrong path, and the path we are on of free trade, we've got to abandon that.
I agree with you, Toby. Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
No, but it sure sounds like this is not the time to buy a house.
This is not the time to buy a house. In fact,
okay.
I could, I'd sell my house, but we have no place to move to, so we have to stay where we are.
All right. Thank
God
you.
Bless. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I guess we're out of time. I want to thank you so very, very much for being with us, and look forward to having you on our program again. That telephone number, if you'd like to get hold of Gus Stelzer, 800-484-9527-1078. That's 800-484-9527-1078. Thanks so much for being with us.
Send me an email, and I check my email every day, and if you send me an email, anybody sends me an email, I'll get back to you.
That's Gus Stelzer at AOL.com. God bless you. Thanks so much, Gus. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, I think that it's always a good program, very, very intelligent. He's 89 years old. I hope when I'm 89, I think as clearly and concisely as he does. Under any circumstances of why, let me remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent on those who are out there listening to us. We're primarily listener-supported. That way we can tell you the truth. We buy time on radio stations all across America. 60 stations will hear at least some of the material that we're putting out. They're going to get the information they'll never get from other sources. If you'd like to be part of our team, part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, why, it's simply call that number, and we'll be glad to send you either the March or the April newsletter. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day there, either on our site or on the other networks we're on. We do 4 hours of shortwave every day, and of course it's 5.745 megahertz, but that's all up on the internet. Your job is to tell other people about our programs, to encourage them to listen. We've got to, like Paul Revere, let people know that trouble is lying ahead. It's not that the redcoats are coming. They're already here. Our government has been taken over by people who have a different agenda. They have a different worldview. Their dedication is not to the preservation of our freedom under God, as laid out in our Declaration of Independence. Their dedication is to the idea of a new world order and a new world religion. And America's wealth and financial power is being used to force all nations into this new system of government that has been the plan of the secret societies since the beginning of time. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to understand that Nimrod wanted a world government, Alexander wanted a world government, Napoleon, Adolf Hitler, and nobody has come closer than Cecil John Rhodes, who shortly before he died in 1902 said, "It'll take 100 years before my dream comes to completion. If you want to read his dream, we have his Confession of Faith. We'll be glad to send it to you." When he talks about the idea gleaming and dancing in front of my eyes, is this, why shouldn't we form a secret society to unite all the underdeveloped nations of the world under British control and reunite with the United States? If you'd like a free copy, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.